this Saturday, St. Patrick's Day, the Kalamazoo Philharmonia will take to the stage to perform a concert of American works, or at least from the Americas. And here to talk about it is conductor Andrew Kohler and a couple of special guests, violin soloist Jessica Hung and composer Sean Newcomb. Thank you all for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thank you, Kara.
Thank you so much.
Nice to have you. Well, Andrew, I'm turning it over to one of the best speakers I know to introduce this concert.
No pressure. well, thanks, Kara. So, you know, with this idea of the Americas, I started to think about how complicated a place the New World is, right? Both North and South America. I mean, there's this legacy of colonialism and native peoples being conquered, and of course, the historical reliance on slavery. All of this has made us, I think, a really complicated series of countries, right? It's not just unique to the United States of America, although maybe we think of it as happening principally here. So I started to think about how composers kind of operate on a spectrum of whether or not they want to be more in dialogue with native kind of folk music customs, whether they're trying to build an art that represents somehow something uniquely American, whether that be Mexican American or United States of American, or whether they're more in dialogue with the European past. And so I chose four composers that kind of operate on different ends and different points along this spectrum. The program opens with a Mexican work by Moncayo. This is a piece that, you know, he did not live very long. I only recently discovered he actually died at the age of 46, and very little time to accomplish what he set out to accomplish. But in this one work, this his Huapango, he managed to sort of assure his immortality. I think a lot of Mexicans think of this as almost a kind of unofficial second national anthem. Mm. And this was recently, this is something that I had read, but this was recently verified for me by Kalamazoo College's president, Jorge Gonzalez, who's Mexican and who unfortunately wasn't able to send his regrets. He couldn't come to the concert this Saturday, but he said, I cannot believe that I have to miss the Huapango. It brings tears to my eyes when I hear it. It means so much to me. It reminds me so much of home. And he even said himself, I think it should be the national anthem of Mexico. So it was amazing. It was like, you know, there it was being proven to me that it really resonates so strongly. And I think one of the reasons why it does is because Moncayo sort of represents that one extreme end, almost an ethno-musicological approach to composition, where he went to a region in Mexico, Veracruz, which he felt was unsullied by modernism, you know, still had the sort of pure connection to folk music, and listened first and notated what he heard and made notes about the instrumentation and the particular subtle ways in which the melody might be varied from one performance to the next, and then use that as a starting point for creating his orchestral composition.
Moncayo lived from what era?
He was alive in the early 20th century. So he was sort of a student of Carlos Chavez. He was also a student briefly of Aaron Copland. He went to what is now Tanglewood, the summer home of the Boston Symphony. He lived until right around the World War II era is when he passed away.
The piece Huapango is also beloved by players. They really like when this locks in.
Exactly.
It is a great, fun piece to play.
It is exactly that. And it's so rhythmically propulsive the entire time. I mean, it's about an 8-minute work, and I would say there's almost never a bar where there isn't some sort of subtle rhythmic transformation happening, some interplay between twos and threes that kind of give it its characteristic jolt, and it is quite difficult in a way to make sure that when we can hear across the stage because of all these subtleties, but when it starts to happen and when it starts to lock in, it is a really thrilling ride.
The concert Americas opens on Saturday night with Huapango by Moncayo. And in a minute after we hear some of this music, we'll be back to hear about a new work that'll be premiered, I believe, tonight or Saturday night.
Exactly so.
And we'll hear a little bit about music of Barber and Gershwin. Andrew Kohler here with Jessica Hung and Sean Newcomb. Why don't we listen to Huapango? That's Huapango by Moncayo, and we are dancing here in the studio with conductor Andrew Kohler of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia, which must be very excited to start its concert with that piece on Saturday night. This is a ticketed event. You can get tickets right at the door or by calling 337-7070. Kalamazoo Philharmonia online as well. And now's a good time to reintroduce your soloist, Jessica Hung, and composer Sean Newcomb, who will have the first performance on Saturday of his new violin concerto. Congratulations, Sean.
Thank you.
It's looking like, I would think for any composer, the premiere is a significant moment in your life. And would you tell us a little about how you worked up to this and how the commission came about?
Sure. I know Jessica from back in school, and I had been writing some solo violin sonatas, and I think I sent a couple your way.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You're like, hey, I'm going to write you one.
That's right. I thought I was just going to select from, I think, about four violin sonatas that Sean had already written for a recital. I just was really captivated by his music, and in a way that I usually am not, to be quite honest, with contemporary composers. But Sean's music is different in that the style is, it's so very reminiscent of other composers that I know and love, both from the European tradition, and I think there was one sonata that was more of a fiddle style. And then Sean surprised me and said he would just write a brand new one, so...
As composers do.
And it's not a sonata, but a concerto.
Yeah. And so after we did the sonata, there seemed to be a good rapport. I thought she sounded fantastic. And so I actually approached the parties concerned and said, hey, what if I wrote a violin concerto for Jessica?
Oh, okay. So the sonata was the beginning of
Correct. That was like a mini warm-up, I guess.
What school were you at when you met?
We were at the Cleveland Institute of Music.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Sean, were you also a performer, or was composing something you started doing pretty early on?
I've always been a performer. I did all my schooling in violin playing. But very early on, I was writing what I would call exercises, just because it's really easy to compartmentalize composing and performing, but really they're one of the same cloth and one informs the other. And that's something that in general can be lost today. So I've been writing basically as long as I've been playing. Grew up in a household where my dad was always writing for us. He taught us and he taught his students and wrote stuff for them. So it just seemed something you do. And maybe about 10 years, 15 years into doing that, I started thinking of myself as a composer. And then now that's a big part of what I do along with the performing is writing for what's needed.
And are you mostly commissioned for these works, or do you continue to write and share them with friends?
Both.
Is it a mixture?
Both. I play in a string quartet. That's my main job, and I do a lot of writing for us as needed for educational shows or for concerts or new projects, multimedia works. Something like the concerto is an instance where I love Jessica's musical sensibilities and humanistic sensibilities. So I'm more interested in getting to work with people who have something to say with music and art and less interested in getting works performed. So it ends up being mainly that I do commissions, but not because I'm searching for that, but because I'm not trying to be what I might blithely call a career composer. I'm just trying to be a musician and push my understanding and love of it.
Very good, yeah. What's the name of the quartet, by the way?
Bayo String Quartet.
Bayo String Quartet. And based in
Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh.
Yep.
Oh, nice. Hey, there's the connection. Well, you're from Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's those are opposite worlds. We actually just had a conversation in the car on the way over where Sean, who grew up in, was it North Dakota? Is that right?
Yeah.
Said that Pittsburgh seems very East Coast. And I grew up in Philadelphia, and I was like, no, that's the Midwest. Sorry, Pittsburgh is already in the Midwest. So totally shifting perspectives.
Yeah, I'm up here in Michigan going, roughly Pennsylvania, sort of the same. Jessica, where did you grow up?
Well, that's how I feel, too. I'm sure I would just get Philadelphia and Pittsburgh mixed up. I grew up in the Chicago area. And so actually the connection with Andrew is that we had gone to Northwestern University together. So I met both of these guys in college. It was just different at different schools. So, yeah.
Do you pursue solo playing, or are you also in chamber ensembles and orchestras and things like that?
So my primary job is an orchestral job. It's as concertmaster of the Dayton Philharmonic,
wow.
Which is in Southwest Ohio, which I do still consider the Midwest, although perhaps it's getting pretty far south at that point. But that's my full-time job, and it's really enjoyable. I get to do all kinds of music. We're actually a merged organization now called the Dayton Performing Arts Alliance, so we do a lot of ballet and opera as well. We're all under one roof as far as those different kinds of performing arts.
Fantastic.
So that's my main job, and then occasionally I get to do some big solo things as well. So this is definitely the highlight of my season.
Just like you were helpful in describing Sean's sound, maybe Andrew, you could be helpful in describing what you like about Jessica's playing.
Oh, well, I mean, if you like violin playing, then it's really, I mean, I words will not do it justice. You just have to hear it because it's brilliant violin playing. I mean, she's Jessica. Okay, so I'll flatter you with some of your bio moments. What age were you concertmaster of the Civic Orchestra in Chicago?
Oh, it's hard for me to remember what.
Yeah,
because
you were.
Yeah,
you were
in high school,
a kid, right? Exactly. So she was like maybe 15 or something like that, and she was the concertmaster of the Civic Orchestra, which is generally for already graduated conservatory students, you know, sort of pre-professional. And at that tender age, she was already concertmaster. I mean, she just has virtually flawless technique, and that's of course only the first step in any great artist, right? There's also just this well of pathos and of understanding and of sort of, I think Sean put it very beautifully, of humanity that she's able to communicate very vitally when she's on stage in any capacity. I mean, I definitely, you know, we got to know each other at Northwestern because I saw her across the stage in the orchestra where I was also playing, even though I was a conducting student there, and just immediately made note of this just dazzling violinist across the stage who communicated very deeply her understanding of music at a far too annoyingly precocious age, I'll say.
Jessica Hung will be the soloist this Saturday at 8 o'clock in a concert called Americus by the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. And Andrew Kohler will be conducting the premiere of a work by Sean Newcomb. Now's the time where we try to describe this piece, which has not yet been premiered. And maybe I'll go back to you, Andrew, too. No, I'm skipping you. I'm going back to Sean.
Oh, good, because you know how they say it's like talking about music is like dancing about architecture. So good luck with Sean. Good luck with this, Sean. Talk about your piece.
No, simple question. Did you set out with any goals when putting this piece together?
Yeah, I think the challenge would be minimizing the goals, not finding the goal. It's really fun to hear Andrew and Jessica talk about the concerto because all of us bring our perspectives from how we see it. For me, a violin concerto is a very special piece of music. And as I told Jessica and I learned from my dad, all of the best violin concertos have been written, probably. And so my goal is not to try and write what I think is an amazing, the best violin concerto, what an ECT concerto could be, but rather to take into account the listeners of today. We have all been shaped over centuries, and the listener who heard Tchaikovsky violin concerto is not the same listener today. So how do I capture the emotions and the affects that have affected so many people over centuries that with past violin concertos, how do I create that for today's listeners with where we are? And it's, for me, a balance of keeping in check the idea of wanting to push music or evolve it with the constant sliding scale of what we want to hear as a populace right now, but also then finding that balance of just challenging that enough where someone can walk away and hopefully want to hear it again and maybe not be really sure of the words to describe what they heard, because at the end of the day, that's what makes music so amazing, is it can push our sense of consciousness because we have to find words to describe an experience that we've just had that we could only have through music.
I love what you just said. I'm going to leave it at that and ask another basic question. What is the... did you use a traditional form? Do we have three movements here?
Oh. It's three movements. Yeah. I think familiarity is such an important thing for every listener today. And familiarity in this concerto comes in a couple forms. One is it's three movements, standard, fast, slow, fast, for lack of a not wanting to get too detailed. And then it's obsessive. You get an introductory motive that Jessica plays, and almost the entire piece is constructed around this. And that is not for the sake of craft so much, it is for the sake of familiarity, that upon one listen, a listener could maybe walk away and feel that by the end of the concerto, they knew that motive, even if they don't think about it consciously walking away, oh, I love that motive, but that there's a sense of knowing it just because it's been there so much.
Is it your first violin concerto?
It is my first and last violin concerto, yes.
Never say never. What makes you say that it'll be your last?
There's a lot of other good things I'm sure to explore, and I'm definitely about the journey, and I don't think I could have a much better journey than I've had doing this concerto.
Jessica, what would you add to what Sean just said about his intentions with this concerto, and how does it feel to play it?
What I love about Sean and his music is just how it is very well thought out, I'm sure to a much higher degree than I'm even, you know, capable of understanding as just the performer, but I hope that I am conveying some of what he wants. So when he talks about the opening theme, for me, in some ways, it's very technically challenging because there are all these kind of dissonant intervals and sevenths, and there are a lot of leaps and shifts on the violin. And so while I'm working on the piece, of course, I'm focused on that, trying to just play it in tune. But then when I get together with Sean to work on it, he, in some ways, doesn't really mind if I'm playing the wrong notes, which I hope not to be doing very much of, but he's so much more interested in the shape of the line, or perhaps that we had slightly different conceptions at the beginning, where I think I was actually playing the theme too expressively immediately, so a little bit too indulgent and slow, and then realized just at the rehearsal yesterday that it sort of starts out a little bit more mysterious and then kind of grows into something that's more recognizable as a melody. So it's just even like having conversations like that and dialogue in rehearsal, I think, is very rewarding just compared to, you know, other situations where rehearsal time is really tight and you're just trying to put something together, or, you know, make sure something doesn't fall apart. So this is really the opposite of really trying to get to know the piece inside out, if possible. Again, the tonalities and the language are very challenging sometimes, but I think I'm getting a better sense each day, hopefully leading up to the performance, of what it's about.
Yeah. So. The premiere is Saturday night at 8:00, and Andrew Kohler will be conducting. Just ask for your thoughts, especially as regards the piece as a whole, and maybe the orchestration, what he has the orchestra do to support the soloist.
Well, just this morning, Sean said to me, you know, maybe I should have, I hope you don't mind my saying this, maybe I should have titled this Concerto for Violin and Orchestra, or Concerto for Orchestra and Violin, or something like that. In other words, that there is a rather prominent role for the orchestra in this piece, and that it is deeply involved and very much in conversation with the soloist. That's true, of course, of a lot of great concertos, but I think Sean has sort of stepped it up. So the way that this motive, this all-encompassing motive that he mentions, you know, runs through a lot of the orchestra parts, and also the orchestra in some cases even interrupts Jessica, you know, so it's not the idea that she is always absolutely unequivocally the star, but sometimes the orchestra actually steps on her toes in this dance that we do a little bit and overtakes her. Sean even writes into the score a couple times, something like, don't be afraid to cover the soloist here. That's okay. This is intentional. You know, I've orchestrated in a way that would make it difficult for one lone violin to cut through the din, but that's on purpose. So that's always a nice freedom for an orchestra to just let loose and not feel like we have to tiptoe around the soloist. There's that, and I would say also that one of the things that really strikes me, again, to return to the overall program, is how Sean is in a lot of ways, to me, kind of in dialogue with, European modernism. In the sense that I think some of these techniques he's using are descended from techniques of the Second Viennese School, like serial music. It's not serial music in any way. I don't wish to suggest that it is, but the conception, you know, the idea of taking a number of notes and then using that as a platform from which all else grows is very much rooted in those Schoenbergian techniques, which in turn are also descended from Bach techniques and Beethoven techniques. You know, I mean, there's a long legacy there that's being drawn upon. So yeah, very much in conversation with that tradition, but also the other side of it is that that music was highly expressionistic, and I think that also comes through in Sean's music. In other words, even if the language can be challenging sometimes, I think the big idea, the gesture, right, the epicness of certain moments, the biting sarcasm of other moments, these are intelligible for us as listeners, as performers. That's something that Jessica brings across so brilliantly, and I hope that the orchestra can keep up with her in that regard.
And perhaps if Sean Newcomb here got his feelings onto the page, then we as modern audiences will really feel a resonance with our own bigger world.
I think that's what art is always attempting to do at all times, right? And our sensibilities change, as Sean points out. And I think he's found a way to speak to an audience in a way that does not sound derivative. You know, when I say that he's in conversation with these older traditions, I don't wish to suggest that he just sounds like them. He doesn't, you know, like every great artwork, he has sort of consumed the past and then reformatted it to something that makes sense to a contemporary audience.
Sean Newcomb's first and possibly only violin concerto will be premiered Saturday night at Kalamazoo College. The concert will be held in the Dalton Theater of the Light Fine Arts Building. Music begins at 8 p.m. and tickets are available at the door. The Kalamazoo Philharmonia website has other information as well. Earlier in the interview, you said you chose a number of composers for this program that each took a slightly different approach to whether to take materials from the New World and kind of create something of America, or mm-hmm. to kind of continue a tradition that was taken from the Europeans.
Right.
And here we have Samuel Barber, and I think I know the answer to this question.
Yeah, I think you do too. Yeah.
I think he dearly loved the Europe
absolutely
composers, yeah. And this was sort of the mantle he picked up.
That's absolutely accurate. In fact, I found a lovely quote from him that I think succinctly sums up how he felt about a lot of the trends that were going on around him, especially, you know, some of these more modernistic music trends, which at that time were already happening in Europe. So, you know, I was just saying that Sean maybe is in conversation with European modernism, and then Barber, who lived through the era of European modernism, was very much in conversation with European romanticism of a generation earlier. And Barber summed this up by saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, something like, skyscrapers, subways, and trains play no role in the music that I write. that is a way to say, you know, like all this exciting, new, modern, here we are in the city kind of stuff, that's not my sound. That's not what I am intending to capture. For him, as in a way with Sean, I think fundamentally the emotional, humanistic experience was paramount. And he too, for his age, wanted to find a language that again was not merely a repetition, but but something that was unique and at the same time moored enough in tradition that it could speak immediately to the audience. And he succeeded wildly. I mean, when we think of composers of that era, I can think of few who would have been able to write something like the Adagio for strings, right? Which is so beautiful and so immediately affecting for an audience that from the first premiere until the modern day, it's become a kind of shorthand for American mourning, right? And it's something that I think any listener will immediately feel a connection to. I think that's an extraordinary accomplishment, even if at the time some sort of looked down their nose at Barber and said, oh, well, he's just writing this old-fashioned stuff or it's not cutting edge enough. But I think his concern was more about, again, the humanistic experience, about a communication with the audience. And that comes out very beautifully in his second essay.
You love these essays. There's three orchestral essays
yes.
by Barber.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is a funny name for a piece.
Yeah, I've never done any of the essays before, though, I have to say, although I do so admire these works. I mean, one of the things that strikes me so much about the second essay is that it's about 10 minutes long, and I feel as if I've listened to an entire symphony by the time I finished, you know? Mm-hmm. There's such tautness, such economy of means, and yet such profundity of expression, which is exactly why he uses borrows the literary term essay, right? That idea of economy, but also depth of thought. And he gets both of those things. Like Sean, he's very concerned with, taking the initial thematic material and really using that in every way that you can imagine, recombining it in new ways, having it show up in very different guises. So something that was lyrical when we hear it first can be very fast and propulsive and exciting, and then can feel almost dirge-like at the end, you know. And it's a really extraordinary journey, and I can think of few composers who could take us so far with such paucity of material and in so little time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The second essay was a product, he said, perhaps, there's no program, he admitted, but perhaps listeners might hear that it was written in wartime, which I have to confess I don't know that I did until I read him saying that. But at the same time, I can see what he's getting at. There is a sort of unease at the beginning. There's the materials, the principal materials presented very starkly with a flute accompanied by a low tuba note and a bass drum, which I think is brilliant because it's, you know, sonically and geographically distant on stage from where the flute sits, you know, so you had this sense of spaciousness and also isolation at the same time. And then from that theme, all else is possible. It's an incredible 10 minutes of music, I think, and again speaks to how Barber was able to so immediately grab and communicate with an audience, just like Sean does.
I'm going to tease that the concert will end in a very different way with a bit of one of Gershwin's greatest. But let's listen to, you used the word profundity. Profound is the perfect word for Samuel Barber, I think, and profoundly beautiful as well. Let's hear some of the second essay for orchestra. My guests, Andrew Kohler, Jessica Hung, and Sean Newcomb, all appearing on Saturday night at 8 p.m. in the Dalton Theater of the Light Fine Arts Building at Kalamazoo College. Tickets and more information at the Kalamazoo Philharmonia website. From the second essay for orchestra by Samuel Barber, we just listened to an excerpt. Here in the studio is conductor Andrew Kohler, who's conducting the work on Saturday with the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. And we're in the last few minutes of this hour. It's an exciting piece. I didn't realize it quite got to that intensity. Often the essays start in such a not mild, but subtle.
Yes, absolutely. Right. But maybe this is what he meant when he said you can hear that it's perhaps written in wartime. I mean, there's some real drama going on here. And again, it just shows the range of what he can do with this melody, because what we just heard thundering out there is the same thing that the flute played in that lonely, isolated way at the beginning of the piece.
Fantastic. Well, how does this concert come to a conclusion?
Well, we've gone from the very detailed conversation with sort of native-born tradition of Moncayo to a conversation with the European heritage, perhaps, in Sean's music and in Barber's music. And now the pendulum swings to the middle somewhere in the music of George Gershwin, who, of course, was very much interested in the jazz idiom, right, which in many ways is true native-born, grew out of slave spirituals and African rhythms, and became an art form that I think in a lot of ways was synonymous with America and with the cities and with African-American culture in America. And Gershwin, although himself obviously not African-American, was conversant in the style, grew up cutting his teeth in Tin Pan Alley. When he finally wrote an opera, Porgy and Bess, he insisted on an all-black cast because he thought that was the only way to really bring these things across. At the same time, he also was interested in these European techniques. He kept trying to go to Europe to study with Nadia Boulanger, with Maurice Ravel, with Alban Berg. He was sort of really impressed with him as well. And all these guys just sort of said, oh, you're making too much money already. You're fine. Just keep being George Gershwin.
You don't need my help.
Exactly. Don't bother us. But sure enough, he really pushed himself to understand how he could take these sort of techniques of developing thematic material. And in a lot of ways, this piece, An American in Paris, is the direct result of this. First of all, he was that American in Paris who was there to try and study with Boulanger, who turned him down. So that's part of the experience. And the piece itself is, of course, a lot of great tunes, because, I mean, Gershwin just, it seemed like they just slid off of him. He was one of the great, I think, tune writers, along with figures like Tchaikovsky and Schubert, and in a very much jazz-inflected idiom, and yet rigorously combined and recombined and developed according to these European methods. So he was attempting, in a lot of ways, to be the great uniter, I think, to bridge the divide between native styles and imported European styles and find common ground between them. Mm. And An American in Paris is this wonderful work that absolutely, as he said, stands on its own as a sort of abstract musical conception, because the thematic material is so well worked out and really in a very sophisticated way. And at the same time, also functions as a kind of tone poem, because it is about his experience and his impressions of being, as the title suggests, an American walking around Paris, sort of dazzled by the lights and the experience. And there's this wonderful narrative that a writer and composer, Deems Taylor, wrote to describe the experience, or sort of to for the premiere performance to help people understand what was going on, which he did with Gershwin's consent and obviously insight. So I think some of these are, let's say, a little bit less guesswork than they might otherwise be for a lot of other compositions of this sort. And it's really, there's a lovely, basically the idea is he's walking along, dodging taxi cabs. Mm-hmm. There's a central section where they play the blues, and sure enough, it's about him being homesick, which makes perfect sense. But then he finds, presumably, another American, and they dance a Charleston together, and that raises his spirits. And he realizes, okay, it might not be home, but after all, it's Paris, and this is a pretty swell place.
Now, because there was a movie, and because this is often played as a concert piece, I'm a little confused. Was this originally a ballet?
No, it was not. It was a concert work for orchestra, premiered by the New York Philharmonic, and Walter Damrosch conducting.
I see dancing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Every time I think of
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
So. Yeah. Well, it The word ballet has never been attached to this work, I guess.
I mean, maybe subsequent. I'm sure it's been choreographed subsequently.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's a and of course there's a Charleston at the end, which was a popular dance of the day. But this was, at least in Gershwin's conception, initially intended for the concert stage, as we will perform it on Saturday.
Okay. Well, I think we have to end it there and hope that we have piqued the interest of lots of people who want to enjoy a live evening of music at Kalamazoo College on Saturday night. Tickets will be available at the door, and you can find out more by calling 337-7070 or go to the Kalamazoo Philharmonia website. Sean, Jessica, and Andrew, thank you very much for joining me on WMUK.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.